Mindfulness. I'm in southern Utah, down in Torrey. And I guess people are social distancing. It's hard for me to tell when I go to the grocery store. It's unclear. I'm the only one wearing a mask. And then I seem like I'm a bandit. A bandit and a liberal. So it's great to see you. I know some of you are coming in from Salt Lake City from our usual Sunday morning class, and some of you are coming in from different places around the world or around the globe. And roll over to page 2 to make sure I can kind of get a glimpse of everybody who's online today. So I would love, if you wouldn't mind, you know, we're all still living in kind of unusual situation, and one that can be pressurizing and stressful and life-threatening, depending on who you are and who's in your life and whether they happen to be ill or not. So I would love if you would, in the chat, put a couple words in there just letting me know how you're doing under these circumstances and what's coming up for you. Fed up, yeah. Restlessness, yeah. Happiness, doing well. Good, good. Mark, I was thinking about you, Mark Evans, and all those nice pictures of you on Facebook, and hoping I can talk you into coming to Torrey and taking us out for a whole day somewhere. Settled and content. In the garden a lot, yeah, that's helpful. Settled in, doing okay. Strengthening relationships, good. Moody, fatigue for sure, fatiguely held. Wonderful, mixed. Learning to be better at love. Well, can't go wrong there. Enjoying nature, me too. Up and down. Yeah, I noticed the little bit that when what I notice is when I feel emotionally out of balance, or I notice the pressures are greater. I notice that I'm more extreme in my feelings, and the challenges feel a little bit greater. And then Julie and I were talking last night too about just feeling that our energy is not quite as stable. You know, the amount of energy that we're used to being able to count on isn't quite there. I don't know if others of you are having that experience, that you can't quite count on your energy levels in the way maybe that we've been able to. So the question that really comes to mind, of course, is what is the role of practice, and particularly of Buddhist practice, as a mindfulness awareness course, so we don't focus entirely on the way in which meditation is engaged, interpreted, and manifested, you might say, in the Zen world. Although certainly, because my training has mainly been in the Zen tradition, that comes up. But at the heart of all Buddhist meditation, of course, is sitting still. Sitting still, quieting the discursive mind, opening up what we call the experiencing network, experiencing body, heart, mind, environment, and the world as one, in which even though there are challenges and problems, we're not separate from them, and we don't necessarily relate to them as problems to be solved, but challenges to be engaged and lived, and that the quality of our presence, of our insight, and the ripening of our compassion towards ourselves and towards others is really the fruition of our practice, you might say. And so I know for me that whenever I've experienced challenging times, I think I came to sitting through being challenged. I mean, those of you who know my story know that I lost 7 very close friends. These days, the idea that I would have 7 close friends is I have 7 close people. There's something about when you're a teenager, there's a different valence in a way to friendship. But 4 of my friends were killed in a light plane. 1 was killed in a knife fight. 1 committed suicide with cyanide. He was a chemist. And another one was killed in a mobile accident. So for me at that time, my entire world was turned upside down, and I was confronted with the reality of death, and particularly untimely deaths in a way that just changed my whole relationship to life. I needed to understand, who am I as a human being in the face of birth and death? You know, not with some sort of conventional view that my life was about growing up and being married and having an identity or a job or a role and gradually growing old and dying, but rather that impermanence is very alive and real, that the struggle of being a human being is right here now, and that what do I do with this life and this, you might say, intelligence of being human in the face of that? What does it mean that we're born, we live, we die, we suffer? So that, of course, for whatever reason, the Buddhist school scratched the itch for me. There was something about the willingness, maybe the first noble truth of just acknowledging how much suffering there is in this existence and how challenging it can be, and then really putting myself in relationship to impermanence, to egolessness. Those are called the three marks of existence in the Buddhist tradition: impermanence, suffering, and egolessness, or the kind of, you might say, the possibility that our identity is more than we think it is. Maybe that's one way to talk about it. And so this practice I came to the practice because of these challenges and deepened into the practice, and it answered these existential questions, not conceptually, but literally, you know, I don't even know how to describe it, in an embodied way. I saw my mind come to rest and saw my heart open, and I no longer even needed to conceive of the challenges in the way that I did. So it answered something in me very deeply. And then maybe the second major challenge was when I had my son who was born with Down syndrome, and feeling, I was 30, so it was about maybe 8 years after I started to practice meditation. And by then, the practice had ripened, you know, in me. It was very stable and was a feature of my life at that point. It wasn't something I was embarking on to find, but rather something that I had already integrated. And at that point, the practice and the view of non-duality, one might say, you know, that within something like Down syndrome, that Down syndrome is not simply a negative experience, that there's grief, there's loss, there's uncertainty. And then there's also you might say the upside of it. And that for whatever reason, when my son was born, it allowed me to really experience both very profoundly at the same time, that I could be celebrative and joyous and enjoy his being and be curious about what this experience would be like and simply experience mothering because that was just the same. And then also see my mind go to the future and be afraid of, you know, what would happen. Would he find love? Would he get married? What was school going to be like for him? So the practice was extremely important at that time. And it wasn't so much around a search. It was more around the realization of how profound it is to see that each experience, in it, every experience can be held and, not held isn't the right word, every experience has a fullness to it when we're able to be present. And that, Trungpa Rinpoche likes to say, everything is workable, no matter how challenging it is. And there's an innate dignity to our willingness to experience what comes up for us and the challenges of being a human being. So we're challenged right now. We're in a context in which maybe our challenges are not as immediate, although certainly there's stress. But there are challenges generally, and because we're not separate, knowing that many more people are dying and that doctors and nurses and people in hospitals are experiencing a lot of intensity and stress, and that businesses are suffering, and that people are having to adapt and change their way of being because they've lost income or they've lost health, or that's going on is not separate from who we are. We're not immune. Of course, we're affected by that. But the human heart is really capable. It's function in a way. The mind doesn't endure these things very well. What's good about them is the mind has to give itself over to the heart, because the heart is way more equipped to deal with these times than the mind. So if you're willing, what I would like to do is to invite you into just a little exploration of non-duality. And maybe you can identify right now what feels like good news, what feels like difficulty, and then maybe just even a moment where you're free of that duality altogether and things just simply are as they are. There's no valuation whatsoever of good or bad. You're just simply experiencing, oh, the light on the asparagus coming up in the field, right? Or you're experiencing a quality of anxiety in someone in a grocery store. But there isn't a sense that it's good or bad. It just is what it is. So I'd like to begin today by asking you to explore both the polarity and the place beyond that polarity in your life. So I'll ask Julie to put you into groups of three, and I'll give you about 12 minutes. So you have 3 to 4 minutes apiece and a little bit of time for crosstalk. Let's make it 15 so you can have a little bit of conversation as well. And we'll see you back here at 10:30. All right, would you be willing to share just a little bit with me of maybe what you talked about in your group?
For my polarity, I talked about how I just did Mugaku's virtual session, mm-hmm. and how I was apprehensive of doing a virtual session, but I really enjoyed it and really benefited from it. So mm-hmm. I'm excited that container of being in a virtual session works. And I'm excited for Two Arrows and all the offerings that will come in virtual world. Mm-hmm. And then on the other side, I'm scared for the loss of human connection in the Sangha mm-hmm. during this time. And then the place where I'm non-dual looks like me being more flexible, being more of a team player, and dropping my preferences.
Mm. Very excellent. Very good. Excellent. Who else would like to share? Anybody? Mark Evans, do you want to share?
Sure, I'll share. My polarity was not that different. Well, my life under restriction isn't that different from my previous life. Hmm. And so I just kind of have my usual judgments about myself that I always have. Hmm. And then also saying, well, this is a hard time, so I could be less judgmental. Hmm. And just say, have another cup of coffee. Eat that bag of raisins. don't go any farther than the mailbox today.
Just take it easy, huh?
Yeah, and then a friend of mine invited me to go on a camping trip that wasn't really the kind of thing I like to do. And I thought, I'll just go anyway. We'll just do it his way.
All right, good. Good. And that's you're dropping your preferences, letting yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah. That theme. Great. Good. How about Priya? Do you want to check in and tell us what's up for you?
Sure. So I telework pretty normally in my corporate life. I'm reporting live from Washington, D.C. So.
Hey, thanks for coming in.
Yes. And I think that there's this concept of there's just an abundance of time now. And so we're just on demand 24/7. And I found myself working like 10, 11 hour days where usually I stop at an 8 hour day and have some kind of like yoga class or something else to do. But now I work in a healthcare organization and we're kind of just on demand 24/7.
Full on.
Yeah. And so it's this concept of having too much time and then not enough time. And then time in general is just zipping by, like each day will feel like a week and each week will feel like a month. And then sometimes you don't feel like you have enough time to meet your deadlines. So time is just lost right now. It's like really hard to find balance with just time in general.
That makes sense. Yeah. Thank you for helping out.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, really. Hoping that meditation can give you just a little bit of reprieve and maybe even an experience of timelessness that could be a little bit refreshing.
It does. And in our little breakouts, we were talking about just doing check-ins with yourself. And so there are days or moments where you're not feeling good. It's like checking in, it's like making sure you're not focusing on the news the first thing in the morning or not looking at the news right before bed, but kind of bringing the moments where you do watch the news to the middle of the day so it doesn't hijack your thought process or your sleep patterns or things like that. And then and just like hijacking your well-being in general, making sure you're eating great food so you feel good the next day, and you know, all the things that we do generally to take care of our well-being, but doubling down on it now that we're kind of home in quarantine.
So I'm hearing kind of a polarity there, which is on the one hand many more demands in which I need to be available and responsive. And then on the other hand, a way in which I actually have to be really take care of myself more and not be available or sloppy or unconscious around what I'm doing, because I really need to take care of myself and my energies and my well-being.
Right.
So there's sort of heightened availability on the one hand, and then kind of a more heightened discipline or container around you on the other.
Right, exactly.
Good. Good. All right. Well, let's go ahead and sit, and I'll do a little bit of guided meditation today. And then we can take some questions. Hi, Craig Carter. How are you, Craig? Good to see you. How are you doing?
Good, Roshi. Good. Good to see you.
That's a hefty beard you're sporting, my friend.
Yes, it's good to let things just run wild because I have an excuse.
Well, are we in the David Letterman School of Beards, or were we in the Walt Whitman School of Beards?
I think we're going Walt Whitman, full Walt Whitman here. Yes, definitely.
Nice. Okay, great.
Thank
it's
you.
Work. It's working.
Good.
Yeah. Hi, Kati. How are you? Good. Nice to see you. Thank you again for your compassion meditation. Hi, everybody. All right, so settling in. And as we settle in, just establish your seat. And we can do that by connecting with where our sits bones and our chair or the floor meet one another and the quality of gravity. And just taking a moment to really feel the reliability of gravity itself, how grounding, how dynamic. And sometimes it's nice to move from side to side on your sits bones and just feel the whole of your pelvis back and forth on your sits bones. And then just rotating around on your sits bones, on your pelvis, and feeling the mobility and allowing energy and awareness to really be in your abdomen, in your hara. So the kind of, you can feel a little bit of the earth element and also the water element. I'm going to try and fix my mic so it's not rubbing. And then come to stillness, but allow yourself to retain just a little bit of that buoyancy that the water element provides. And now experience so we have the downward dynamic action of gravity. And I want you to feel the upward kind of ascending experience of your wishes, of your aspiration, of your dreams. Moving from the base of your spine through your pelvis, low back, through your mid back, shoulder blades, base of your neck and shoulders. your neck, your head, and go ahead and feel that upward motion moving through the top of your head to 6 or 8 inches so that you're grounded and elevated at the same time. And in the pauses, just be aware of whatever arises in your field of awareness. And like Mark, see if it's possible to let whatever it is, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant in the mind, to simply be there. So your ears are aligned with your shoulders are aligned with your hips. The front of your body is open and your heart is extended. Your arms are heavy and relaxed. Relax the back of your neck and jaw. Soften your face. Relax your eyes. Relax behind your eyes. Your lips are together, your teeth are apart, and your tongue is resting on your upper palate. And now feel the outline of your form. And expand the outline to a kind of egg shape, energetic. So there's the dense body, the energetic body, and then there's your entire boundless environment. Become aware or notice your breath. And without changing it at all or manipulating it, just simply experience the breath roll in and experience the breath release. And anytime you want to deepen or lengthen the breath, do so naturally. Now become aware of the mind. And I'd like you to cultivate a quality of simple friendliness towards whatever arises in the mind or in the field of your experience generally. Just a little bit of friendliness towards oneself. And you can imagine for just a moment, just turning the volume down on the thinking mind and turning the volume up on all of your experience. This open field of awareness in which sensation, thought, sound, memory, all experience arises in this open, boundless field of awareness. Allow yourself to sit as this open field. And whatever arises in your particular field of awareness, simply allow it to come and to go without evaluating it as good or bad, or right or wrong. And simply experience whatever it is and notice how it passes. Some experiences are very, very fleeting. Some are a little more persistent. But even a persistent experience, like a sensation in the body, shifts and changes. Just allow yourself to be in the flex and flow of whatever arises in your field of awareness. So as you've been noticing objects, how they come, how they go, impressions, sensations, now I'd like to invite you to turn your attention to awareness itself. Just identify as awareness. And without paying attention to sensations or thoughts as they come and go, let's just notice awareness itself for a few minutes. And as you sit as awareness, I can ask you just to notice as awareness, I am boundless, all pervasive. Notice awareness, you are non-seeking and non-grasping. You seem to be free of judgments and of the compulsion to constantly evaluate. Notice that as awareness, that you are not consumed by the past and the future, and in fact are timeless. Notice for a moment as awareness an experience of freedom. And even fulfillment that doesn't seem to be related to objects or conditions. Notice that the objects of awareness and impressions come and they go, but as awareness that you are very stable and very reliable. And then just notice for a few minutes on your own whatever you notice about awareness itself. This is just a little paragraph that I'll read to you while you sit. And this is from a Chinese Zen master. He says, "The field's limits cannot be seen with the eye. Serene and expansive, its directions and corners cannot be found with the mind's conditioning. People who sincerely meditate and authentically arrive trust that the field has always been with them. Square or round, they just enjoy the center. Their conduct and practice accord with this standard. With amazing effectiveness, as numerous as the grains of sands in the river Ganges, they harmoniously mature each other. From this field, our life arises, and from this field, our life is fulfilled. This matter includes everybody. Just go forward and try to see it. People who know its truth nod their heads in agreement." If you like that style of writing about meditation, this is a book called Cultivating the Empty Field by Hongzhe, is his name. And he was Dogen Zenji's greatest influence. So if that interests you. So I'd love to open up the conversation. Questions about your sitting or questions about your life that you want to explore. Or comments.
Can I have a question?
Please.
Hi.
Hi.
So I think I've just been thinking a lot about like this idea of like duality that you were talking about earlier, mm-hmm. and some of my frustrations with that, like in my own life. And during just now, I was kind of making the connection between So I'm a teacher, and this semester I had joined like an anti-racist pedagogy group at the university I teach at, and feeling kind of this frustration too of being grateful that we're meeting in a community to talk about what it means to be anti-racist, and then at the same time leaving those meetings feeling like, yeah, but like now what? You know, like we kind of like get together, we talk about the readings, we have breakout sessions, people share their experiences, but then like I always crave like an action or like to like do something more about it. And I like feel that way in thinking of like dualities in my own life where I'm like, oh, you know, like it's kind of like I feel almost like at this with like the good and the bad, or, you know, the duality of the situation, and then wanting to really make a change, to make a decision to change that kind of internal like struggle.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, let me just reflect what I heard you say. And tell me your first name again.
My name is Kim.
Yeah, Kim. Yeah, it's K-Y-M, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So what I heard you say is that you've joined, and this is at the university where you teach, and that you've joined a collective of people who are interested in engaging and really coming to understand how to identify and to learn how to behave in the world in a non-racist fashion, anti-racist fashion, and that you find it really illuminating and helpful and you like being part of the group. But then when you go out and you leave at the end of the night, you just feel like there's something more that you want to do, that you really want to be engaged with. And one of the things that I think is important is that these kinds of issues that are historical and systemic and all pervasive, they're not just about individual transformation, but they're also about transforming our society and our culture. So from that perspective, I guess I would look at the places where you're having influence. And it seems like the place where you have the most influence in terms of people are in your classrooms. Does that seem right to you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Seems like you're thinking something. Go ahead and share. I'm interested.
I think I have this habit that it's not enough to like sit, I guess, with it, or to just like have a conversation with others about seeing both sides, or like maybe it's even like an insecurity that seeing both sides doesn't change anything about it. Like it's like a fear, I think, that just having an awareness doesn't necessarily equate to change.
Having awareness doesn't necessarily equate change, but change will never occur if there isn't a shift in awareness. So Ken Wilber says that thoughts are things. He says all movements in society are talked about for 100 or 200 years before they actually really become manifest, because it takes that long to change our consciousness and our way of being. So the fact that you're working with your awareness and you're in conversation, you're literally reorganizing your way of perceiving and seeing, and you can be more committed in terms of how you're actually manifesting that. But I think that you're actually doing a lot by just simply being willing to reorganize your whole relationship to the issue of racism. And then what actions extend from that is always, you know, in Zen, we always say it's realization and manifestation, and that you have to hold that as a very deep question. How do you, in your own life and with others, manifest this change? I would just encourage you to be patient and keep going.
Thanks.
And culture doesn't change quickly or easily. It's a big human enterprise. And just think about your life. I don't know how many times you've tried to change your habits. But we need to take a strong stand for the equality of beings. So thank you. And fair sharing of resources with beings. Anybody have anything in relationship to Kim that you want to say about your own life and those big systems issues? Social justice is really just a koan that we have to continue to live. It's not solved in a lifetime by any means. It's sort of like a something that kind of never goes away that we're always working on. We're just prone to one up, one down each other all the time.
Jamie?
Yeah, go ahead, Jamie, please.
Hey, Diane. So for me, there's polarity showing up because I'm actually doing some Ken Wilber work. I'm doing the Actualize LS stuff.
Are you?
I want to more appreciate everyone's position, yet I struggle. So let me give you an example. Yesterday, I'm on a Zoom call at work, 40 or so team members, and one guy piped, and we're talking about how to interact with the public. If the corporation we deal with is wearing masks, do we need, you know, anyway. And someone piped up and said, well, what if you don't believe any of this stuff? And it's difficult for me not to get triggered by that because one of the most important people in my life has asthma and is, you know, potentially a life-threatening illness for her. So I instantly got triggered, which I don't normally do. So I'm struggling to appreciate that person's perspective and yet hold the protective head of the household, you know, that I keep naturally tend to. Mm-hmm. Any suggestions?
Yeah, I mean, I can say some things. I think we're all challenged by, in all domains in our life, by people whose perspectives are different, and particularly where we feel like there's actual empiric data to support our point of view. It's very difficult to remain kind of open and neutral. On the other hand, you know, people do have that perspective, and that perspective is being supported and it's being politicized. So we have to deal with it.
Right.
So one thing that we know is that being able to actually entertain two perspectives at once is an achievement of human development. That under stress, we all go to one truth. It's ours because it makes us feel secure and it helps us know how to act. And as soon as there are multiple perspectives, there's a quality of patience, inclusion, and tolerance. But then what do we actually do? And I hear you saying that. It's even another achievement in human development that we can privilege perspectives. So you can say, based on evidence, based on experts, and based on our firsthand experience of what the death rates and the case numbers are, that this is genuinely a pandemic and people are genuinely threatened. So even though that non-believing perspective exists, you can create a hierarchy of perspectives that actually this one is more true from an empiric point of view. And then you can decide how does one relate to someone who has that particular perspective. So while you can see the truth in the perspective, you don't have to agree with it. And you can also take a stance that it's not good for culture. You know, it's not good for the safety and well-being of others. You can be respectful to that point of view while at the same time fundamentally disagreeing with it and acting differently. And what's going to serve that conversation most that you're in? You know, what will actually support it? You know, it could be something like, I hear that that's your perspective. It's not mine. And I guess maybe what might be an interesting thing to say is, even though you're not concerned about my safety because you're not worried about this, I want you to know that I'm concerned about yours.
Ooh,
and that of your family. So from my point of view, I am going to take precautions because I want your kids and your family to be safe.
Thank you. That's very helpful. I like that.
Okay. And if you do it with, you know, again, some sense that there's a truth, it may be a relative truth, but that perspective exists, whether it's empirically true or not, it exists, right?
Yeah. And that was the struggle. Sorry, keep going.
Yeah. No, that's precisely it. But our experience is always informed by our first person perspectives, by politics and the collective. and by empiricism, and believe it or not, politics trump empiricism a lot. So how do we actually deal with people whose views are really different than ours? Can we do it respectfully and genuinely without saying, oh, sure, and it's also true that it doesn't exist? No, it's just a little bit BS.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You know, challenging times. But it still matters how we treat each other. Even people who disagree with us, it matters. It makes a difference. Yeah, Mayor, go ahead, please.
Roshi, I question the fine line between when emotions come into your awareness, and so they're there, so they're important, they're a value, mm-hmm. but it's an emotion that is more harmful. Mm-hmm. And when to...
Let's reframe that from harmful to an emotion that has not been transmuted yet. Because all emotions are intelligent and all emotions are energetic. If they're expressed without some transmutation, they have the potential to be destructive. Is that fair? Is that a fair frame?
Okay, yeah.
So usually when we have really strong emotion, and if we just give our attention to it, we surrender the storyline for a minute. Let's take jealousy, for instance. The Tibetan Buddhists say that jealousy is the most powerful emotion to deal with, because it's actually three emotions rolled into one, right? So the first is passion, that obviously there's something you want that feels threatened. The second one is aggression. There's aggression towards the one who's getting in the way of your passion, right? And the third is ignorance. Passion, aggression, and ignorance in the Buddhist tradition are the fundamental fixations. And ignorance means this shouldn't be happening. This is wrong, right? So you got passion, you got aggression, you got ignorance. So jealousy is just like golden to work with yourself. So as you sit with the intensity of it, which is a very peculiar emotion, you know, it's complex, right? And it's compelling, and it's that flavor of wanting and hating at the same moment. Can you guys get in touch with that for a second? The experience of both wanting and hating a situation at the same time. You know, those of us who are older, we just like have given it all up at this point. So we're just basically looking for some entertainment through those of you who are still interested. That's not fair. Anyway, that if you let awareness and emotion together, you use breath to just experience the sensations and the life force, you know, like it's so alive to be jealous, right? And that you just let that quality start to clarify. And then you can kind of see that, in fact, you care for something really deeply and you want to protect something that's of value to you. And that's really fine. There's nothing wrong with that. Being true about what you want, wanting to protect that which matters to you. How is that?
So the transmutation of jealousy, would you say, is clarity?
I think it's clarity, and there's a tremendous amount of connectedness to one values. Yeah. Like the heart comes open when jealousy transmutes. You know, there's care, there's love, and there's clarity, both. The aggression becomes more clear and the passion becomes more care. Clarity and care. And then you can own it instead of projecting it onto everybody else. You just own it. This is what I want. This is what I'm going to stand for. This is what I want. Not available to your triad. Thank you very much. Whatever it is. Does that make sense? Okay. Cool. Yeah, we spend a little bit of time during the winter working on the transmutation of emotion, because we have a tendency to either not feel because we just can't bear it, or feel too much and drown in our feelings. So the question becomes, how can we actually experience feeling, let it flower fully, experience its intelligence, experience its energy, experience what it shifts into when the ego relaxes and the experience is allowed to move through the body, and then how do we act in relationship to that that clarity. So that's a practice that I learned from Yom Tran, and it's golden. Sure. You can read a little more about this in my books, Priya. The Everything is Workable, but especially The Zen of You and Me. I have a pretty good chapter. The other person's book that I think is really great, because it's the whole book is on this, is Robert Masters. What's it called, Jules? Emotional Maturity or some, what is his book on emotion called? He takes just a bunch of emotions and helps and kind of unpacks them and helps you sort of see what the transmutation of each emotion is.
Yeah, it's Emotional Intimacy.
Emotional Intimacy, Robert Masters. It's just really accessible. Mm-hmm. So those would be the two pieces. And then, of course, I haven't actually read Daniel Goleman's Emotional Intelligence. I've skimmed it and I've read parts of it. But it, I think Robert's book and my chapter are more practice-oriented. And I think Daniel Goleman's whole elucidation of emotion as a form of intelligence and how there's different levels of emotional maturity, that's sort of it kind of changed in a certain way the work on emotion. So I would recommend those.
You've done books since then, though, that are the application of emotional intelligence.
Okay, Dave. So what's it called? The application of emotional intelligence? Or what's the title?
Not muted? No.
Not yet.
Sorry, Roshi.
No worries. I've
done at least a couple of books since then that are the application of
more practice-oriented.
Into emotional intelligence, yeah.
Okay, great. So yeah, so Daniel Goleman is the big voice in this work. Cool. Thanks, Mayor. I hope that was helpful. And then we get, then we start to kind of allow for ourselves to be emotional beings and to feel. And, I always say to people, do you want to go to movies where you're not moved? Do you want to go to movies in which you don't feel anything? No, of course we want feeling. It's important. Good. Okay, looks like we're good for today. Bye. Thanks for joining, everybody.